The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
I'm Matt Miller.
And I'm Hannah Elliott, and this is Hot Pursuit.
All right, we have a fantastic guest for you today. I'm pretty excited. Hannah, you're the one who brought him to us, and John Hennessy has really become a legend alongside, you know, Carroll Shelby in American
Completely.
Tuning.
And he's done the difficult task of running and operating a car company and actually delivering cars. When they say they're going to make them, they make them, and they actually do it. And he's got a few world records, too.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's a 10-year anniversary of the world record that they set with the Venom GT, which I think Steven Tyler famously had a one-off version
that
built for
make sense.
Himself as a spider. And now it looks like they're going to try that again with their new car, the Venom F5.
Which is super exciting. And John also shared some very enticing little tidbits, too, I have to say, in our conversation. So I'm actually going to be watching Hennessy pretty closely these next few years.
All right, let's get into it with John Hennessy. Let's kick it off with the Venom F5 and Coda.
Okay, sure. Venom F5 went to Circuit of the Americas about a month ago, and we've been doing a little bit of testing up there, just kind of dialing our setup in the car for our customers, and got close to a lap record. And we thought, well, golly, maybe we can come back and see if we can be the fastest production series road car and street tires at Coda. And we did just that. We beat the C Zinger guys. They're from LA. We beat them by 0.4 of a second. We beat the McLaren P1 by about 7 seconds a lap. And I still don't think that we're anywhere near what the F5 is capable around Coda. But again, I think what was kind of a cool thing with kind of demonstrating its capability on the road course, you know, people weren't expecting the Venom F5 to be something that would be capable of going and setting big numbers on racetracks like Coda, like Nürburgring. We haven't gone to the Nürburgring yet, but it's on our list. But we always wanted that Venom F5 to be, you know, my track analogy would be, track and field analogy would be, to be the decathlete of hypercars. So it does, it stops, it turns, it accelerates. Obviously, it's got tremendous power to weight ratio. Again, certain hypercars are known for certain, you know, Bugatti, obviously, the very luxurious and very high top speed. And so anyway, that was a big box for us to check. And we've got a number of other performance records and speed records that we're looking at down the road. But right now, it's nice to validate being the fastest production series road car and street tires at Coda.
John, I have to say a couple things. Number one, I love hearing you say golly, because that is so Texan. And my dad says that. He's the only other person I know says that. So that's a very Texan thing.
Sure.
It's really interesting. You know, we've talked in the past about, you've said, hey, these type of records and these really high speeds are kind of just the result of engineering. They're not even necessarily the goal, because a lot of your buyers are not looking necessarily to own a world record car. Is that, am I remembering right? Is that still accurate?
That is exactly right. You've got an excellent recollection. And exactly to your point, the lap record, like, we didn't go to Coda as a marketing event, as a marketing exercise. We went there basically to develop our car, perfect our car, to simulate our car under conditions that at some point our customers are going to drive it. Again, I don't know that any of our, we've sold about 40 cars. We've delivered 22 F5s to date. I've not had an F5 client say, well, hey, you know, look, I'll be really, really excited if you can set a lap record somewhere. They love the, I tell you what's interesting, what really resonates with our clients, we hear this from almost all of them. They tell us that buying the F5 is as much for the experience with me, with our family, with our company. That's as important to them, the overall experience it is the actual car itself. So what's cool is by developing the car and focusing on engineering and perfecting the product, the byproduct is the speed record. And so, you know, the old saying of form follows function, form follows performance. Really, in this case, the the performance of the car is really just a function of our focus on trying to make the best car that we can make. And the result is we set a lap record. And again, we still feel like there's quite a bit more time left in the car, but we've checked that box. There's other things that we're looking at down the road, but it's cool for our customers to have a bragging right to say, hey, my car is the fastest at this. And again, we've got big goals for the F5, whether it's the VMAX run, the top speed run that we're looking at doing hopefully later this year, and maybe a few other things along the way. So, yeah, I think the story behind the car is very important, but people really like the overall experience and going to Car Week and coming to the factory and inspecting their car and spending time with our clients. It's very experiential, and it's a very boutique part of the process that I enjoy. My family enjoy all of our kids work in our business and are all very involved in the program. So relationships with those clients is really special.
I have to say, just looking at the car, it's gorgeous. I would be happy to own one for just the design, the engineering, the powertrain. I wouldn't need a world record to buy this car. That doesn't mean you're not going to try and set one, right? Currently, I think it's held by the Bugatti at 304 miles per hour or so. And
I think there's a Koenigsegg. I think, and John, tell me if I'm wrong, the Bugatti's a prototype.
Sure.
The Koenigsegg has the production.
Well, in any case, you've set a world record before. Yeah. John, tell us about whole history. Because you set a world record with the Venom GT 10 years ago, basically.
Sure.
And that was beating a Bugatti, at least I've read. And now it seems like you're in the same situation a decade later.
Yeah, it's kind of a funny story. So way back when is the Venom GT came into existence and we had orders and were developing the car, it was always our goal to be the fastest. So at the time, Bugatti with their Veyron Supersport had run a 2A average of 267 miles per hour. And that was the number that we wanted to beat. So when we went to NASA and we're running on the former space shuttle landing runway, on that particular day, we ran 270 miles an hour in one direction. We wanted to turn around and run the opposite direction. So you typically, for Guinness or for FIA or just for the world to recognize an official top speed run, you want to run in both directions. That way you cancel out any wind NASA is very flat, but in the case of Koenigsegg, they ran on a runway or on a highway in Nevada that had a slope to it. So you have to go uphill and downhill. So anyway, we wanted to make the return run, but on that particular day, NASA was testing an autonomous spacecraft called Morpheus on the end of the runway that we were departing from. So we could run, I think we were running from north to south, but they would not allow us to run south to north because they had spacecraft and people on the opposite end of the runway. So we thought, no big deal. So we put that, it went out in the news, and then some of the haters, and I won't say Bugatti's a hater, but they definitely were like, well, that's not official because you didn't run both directions. Yeah. Oh, hey, look, we're friendly competitors. At that time, their CEO is a guy named Wolfgang Dürheimer, whom I got to know. I met him at Car Week. He really liked the fact that we were competing with him. He felt like having that rivalry created relevance in the market, which I totally agreed with. And so we became friends. And so I saw him maybe a couple of years later. I was at Geneva when they were unveiling the Chiron. And he was very busy, shook hands, just chatted for a moment. And as he walked away, he turned around and looked at me over his shoulder and he smiled. And he said, hey, John, make sure next time you run a top speed run, you run both directions. And I laughed. I'm like, okay, man. All right. It's on. And so fast forward. So he's no longer CEO. He retired. And then the Bugatti guys went out and ran their Chiron Supersport back, I think it was in 2019. Amazing number. They ran almost 305 miles per hour. But for whatever reason, they only ran one direction.
Oh,
and I know some of the guys that work there, I'm like, okay, you've left the door open. Now, Hannah, you were mentioning earlier the Koenigsegg guys have run a 2A average. I think it still stands at 278 miles an hour or something like that. They did that back in maybe 2017. So again, we feel like, again, for the VMAX run, for an official production top speed record, you got to run both directions. And to your point, and I don't know this for a fact, I was in that era the same when they ran the car, but it's been mentioned that the car that they ran maybe had some significant modifications that are not necessarily on the road cars that you could buy. So I'm not gonna take any knocks against them if they had a roll cage or they lightened the car, whatever they did to make that run. It's still an astonishing record. It still sets a high bar.
I would want
to look. We love competition. We want to go out and beat that number.
John,
so again,
let me
just Tony Seg if others are playing.
Let me just ask though: is it true that the theoretical top speed of the Venom F5 is over 325 miles per hour? And how do you figure that out?
Yeah. So we've got a team of aerodynamicists internally and externally from the company. The CFD, the aero analysis says with the power that our car is making with its funnel area and drag, it's 328 miles per hour, theoretical top speed. We're not trying to go anywhere near that. But look, I mean, if we could get to 500 kilometers, which is around 311 miles per hour, if we could do that in one direction, I think that would be really cool. But, you know, the thing that really boils down to these top speed runs is where do you do this? A runway, I don't know if the NASA runway in Florida is long enough. We're probably going to have to do it on a highway. And so, look, this is high-stakes poker in that you've got the safety of the driver. You've got the car. You know, so where do we run the car? That's the big thing that we're working on. We feel like we've got the car right now is ready to go make the run, but we're working on a few different things, maybe a longer runway, a little bit longer than NASA, and also the possibility of a Texas highway. So, you know, howdy, yeehaw, you know, all those good Texan things. It'd be kind of fun to do it here in the great state of Texas. We'll see.
Second largest state. I'm curious, can you give us a feel for when you decide to go for a record run? How long is the planning for that? And how much does it cost in general? I mean, is this a big output for the company, or is this it's not that big a deal, for lack of a better word? And then I just also want to say, theoretically, on that 328, it seems like you're saying that the limiting factor on a speed is space. Do tires also come into it, and things specific to the car?
Absolutely. So, first question, it's absolutely a huge deal to do it right. So we have dedicated resources. Our engineering team has actually been working on this for quite a while. So in a variety of phases, so prepping the car, working with Michelin. We were actually in South Carolina and had some meetings with the fine folks at Michelin. They've been a great partner on the tire. So we feel great about the tire. Obviously there's precedent. The Kona Seg guys have run into the 290 range with the Pilot Super Sport Sport Cup 2 tire. So we feel good about the tire, but really, to your point, it's the location, how much distance do we have to work with? Mm. We did a test on, probably 1,200 horsepower. We ran 272 miles per hour with the F5 a couple years ago, just to validate the car before we started delivering to clients. And so I think we can probably run upwards of 300 at NASA, but again, that's nowhere near. We're not trying to get to the theoretical top speed, but we would like to hit that magic 500 kilometer number, at least in one direction. So yeah, there's a ton of time, a ton of resources. It's risky business. As President Kennedy said back in the 60s, we don't do these things because they're easy. We do them because they're hard. So it makes our product better. It makes our engineers, our drivers better. I don't know that I've had a customer say, well, you know, I'll buy the car if it has the top speed record. Yeah, it's probably good for bragging rights. It's probably really good for brand long-term, the long-term value of the car. But again, people are buying the F5 not because of its VMAX potential. They're buying it because it's a piece of automotive art, and it's the most fun vehicle I've ever driven. So that's part of what they're buying. But I think some of them, these guys, men and women that own the F5 and have it on order, they're also savvy investors. They're also somewhat betting on the come that if we do knock off Bugatti and we do set the two-way average, that the likeliness of their car being worth more than they paid for it is going to increase. So we take it very seriously. It's a huge investment of time and money. And it's also, look, there's also risk involved. There's reasons why other manufacturers do not play in this sandbox. It's because it's high-stakes poker. So we take that very seriously, and the safety of our driver and our car. But we're still very intent on doing it. It's just part of our family's DNA, our company's DNA, and it's why, and one of the reasons why we're in this business. We like to push the boundaries. We like to climb the next highest mountain.
Now,
that's what we do.
You mentioned Nürburgring.
Sounds
like you might take the car over. Were you hinting around at that?
Yeah. So look, I mean, it's always been something that's been loosely on our radar screen, but way down the priority list. But
is it not
with
relevant?
The succession coach,
for
oh,
you?
It's totally relevant.
Okay.
It is absolutely relevant. But I will say this, that the degree of difficulty of going fast or being the fastest at the Nordschleife is a higher bar than a top speed run. It's a bigger investment. It's riskier. There's just as many variables in terms of weather.
So much of it is down to the driver,
the track,
right?
It's down to the driver. And look, we've got access to, so I hired a guy, Brian Jones, about 9 months ago who came to me. I didn't seek him out. I didn't even know that I needed him at the time. But Brian was previously the chief engineer of the AMG One. AMG One has the record at the Nordschleife. So I think they ran a 6:32 or 6:33 lap time. So Brian's now my chief engineer, and he feels like we're capable of running a time faster than that. But it's very complicated. It's, you know, 5,000-6,000 miles away. I would have to take a significant part of our team and kind of camp out over there. And ultimately, you're looking for the right day with the right weather. So again, we have other priorities on the record list between now and then, but I could see us doing some testing there in next year. And but you never know. I mean, obviously we're always playing with the big boys, but like, you know, Mercedes, Porsche, so they're very significant competitors, and I'm going to guess at some point, you know, Porsche's not going to sit back and watch Mercedes sit at the top of the leaderboard. They're going to want to knock that off. So back to what we first started talking about, we will go to the Nürburgring to further develop our car and make our car even better. And if as a byproduct, we've got a fast lap time, you know, even if it's not a record time, if we go out and we set a respectable time, we'll put the video out. It's compelling. It's fun. And again, it's something that we want to do. But again, for the long-term brand of the car and the provenance and future value, I think this is another reason why we do these things is because, you know, at some point, I feel like we build the world's greatest internal combustion powered hypercar currently, but at some point there may not be internal combustion powered hypercar. So we kind of feel like it's our duty to be kind of a part of history as much as we can.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
I want to ask first about Hennessy Performance, because it's hard to really pinpoint the company. You tune, the way I found out about the company, you know, 10 years ago or 15 years ago, you tune other cars. So I wanted to, you know, get your supercharger kit for my Tahoe way back when. And you do, you know,
sure,
obviously a number of manufacturers' products, but you also make these cars, which I think compete with more like Pagani and Bugatti, McLaren and Koenigsegg than, you know, Porsche or Mercedes that you mentioned. Explain the way you think about Hennessy Performance to us.
Sure. So we basically have three different divisions within the company. Hennessy Performance modifies. We make fast cars and trucks go faster. So Broncos, Raptors, Mustangs, Corvettes, things of that nature. The last couple of years, we built just under 600 vehicles. So again, you come to us, you want something that's fast. It's probably in the $100,000 to $250,000 price range. That's what we build. You might own the vehicle and send it to us. You might call us up and just want to buy a turnkey vehicle. So that's from a revenue standpoint, since this is Bloomberg, that's about half of our revenue. The other half, predominant other half of our revenue, is from F5 production. So again, about 11 cars a year, the last 2 years. Then we have another division of the business that we don't really talk about a lot, but it's a huge part of our culture. And that's our trade school called Tuner School, where we teach people how to modify cars. We have classes three semesters a year. The students are 18 to 35 year old men and women, both come to Tuner School. They're here for 4 months, 14 weeks. And so that's about 40% of our work staff. We have just under 100 employees. About 40% of the people that work here at Hennessy have come out of Tuner School. So it's a really important part of our workforce.
It's
not a big part of our top line
business.
Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. And so this overall machine, they're very, again, we have different divisions, but they all interrelate to each other, where our best and our brightest that come out of Hennessy Performance generally will migrate over to the Hennessy Special Vehicle side of the business, building and developing the F5. We also are growing our engineering department significantly under Brian Jones' leadership. Again, previously with Multimatic, he was chief engineer for AMG One and for Ford GT. And so, look, we've been around for 33 years. People have heard our name, whether it's modified Vipers, the Venom Viper, Mustangs, Camaros, Raptors, Velociraptors. That's what we're really known for. But I promise you this, we are setting up the company for success and growth for the next 100 years. And our kids, we have five kids plus a son-in-law, they're all involved in the business in some form or fashion. It started off as a crazy idea, me wanting to modify a Mitsubishi 3000 GT and race it back in 1991, but it's turned into a really neat business and neat brand.
That's a Radwood car.
We've got.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I got a nice little personal collection with a number of Radwood cars. So, yeah, fun stuff.
I'm curious. You mentioned that you're thinking about the next 100 years, and I can't help but think that there have been so many automotive startups that have come and gone over the years. Matt and I in our line of work see them come and go. I'd be curious to know, to what do you attribute your ability to really actually not just show a car at a car show and not just make one or two that are trotted around everywhere, but actually be producing vehicles for clients? Because it's a very difficult thing to do.
It is, and I don't take it for granted. I'm grateful every single day, and I guess if I'm going to go down just kind of my mental gratitude list of how do we get where we are and what's going to get us where we want to go, I think that's our people. Starts with like, again, our kids are grown now. We've gotten through Baylor tuition and all that, private school for some of them, and so that was a huge motivator. So again, back to the old saying of for NASA, failure was never an option. So. I've got five little kids and five kids in school and a wife that depended on me. But again, as we've kind of evolved from that, now we have 100 families that work here in the business. So, it's been pivotal for us and for our family to have the right people on the team. So whether it's accounting and finance, whether it's marketing, whether it's engineering, whether it's design, I really feel like we have eight players and best in class talent here that would compete with any of the bigger OEMs that are operating, obviously, on a much, much larger scale. But, as my friend Joe Jacuzzi he works at GM now, told me many years ago, don't believe your own BS.
Yeah.
Don't believe your own press. We all have egos that we all have to put in check. And I'm definitely, one of those people. But I guess as I've gotten older and hopefully a little bit wiser, try to keep that ego in check.
Did Joe
really just have great people and trust our people?
Did Joe did Joe help you start up your business? Because I've heard you talk about kind of your origin story, and Jacuzzi always plays into it.
I'll tell a quick Jacuzzi story. So I'm at Bonneville in 1991 with my 3000 GT VR4, and the very nice people at Mitsubishi Motors in California decided to send Joe, who was in their PR department, out with a freelancer, a guy named C. Van Toon. Van's still a very close friend. Van rose up to be the editor-in-chief at MotorTrend back in the mid to late 90s. And so Joe and Van showed up when I was just about to get into a fist fight with one of the marshals in the pits, who said, you can't drive your car under its own power. I'm like, well, I drove here. I didn't trailer my car. And the guy's like, what? Nobody drives their car to Bonneville, but I did. I had my luggage and my floor jack and my suitcase and helmet in the back. Anyway, so Van and Joe pull up just as I was getting ready to really get into it with this guy. And they were like, oh, we got a minivan. We can tow John around. So we became friends at Bonneville. I set a class record at Bonneville. And then Joe was so kind. Joe said, hey, look, I really like your story. I really like what you're doing. If you come down to L.A. after Bonneville, I'll take you around. I'll introduce you to some of the automotive. Back then, it was just car magazines, right? So the car magazine guys. And I've read car magazines ever since I could read. I'm like, oh, that'll be so much fun. So I go down and do that, meet guys from Jeff Carr at MotorTrend and guys from Hot Rod and Car Craft and Car and Driver. I've been gone from home now for like 3 weeks. I'm like, I'm ready to go home. Joe said, hey, look, trust me. If these guys like you and they like your car and they write something nice about you, your phone will ring. And sure enough, 2 months later, magazine comes out, my phone started ringing, people wanted to buy our stuff. So Joe taught me a very, very important lesson. I didn't even know what the concept of earned media was back then. But at that point, once I learned that lesson, pretty much every time forward, when somebody from a major car magazine would call me up and said, hey, we need a car to go do something stupid and crazy, like me driving 200 miles an hour in a Viper around the Honda Proving Grounds in California City. That was a scary moment. But anyway, I would just say yes. And so that's, I think, how we began the process of building a brand going back in, you know, almost 30 years ago. So I credit my friend Joe Jacuzzi to that. We still talk. I'll probably see him in Detroit in a couple of weeks. He's a dear friend and been a very, very kind to kind of help guide me along the way.
So I have to ask, is 200 miles an hour the fastest you've driven, John?
Personally?
What's the quickest?
Venom GT, I hit 243, and F5, wow. I think I'm around 220 without, you know, again, when we're out at NASA, we're testing the car, we've got a pro in the car. They're not going to just let me just jump in it and go yeehaw, but I'm going to do that at some point.
What does that feel like? What is that speed?
You know, I mean, so we have a little drag strip out behind our factory here. So in the F5, even at 175, it's very accelerating. But I mean, in the case of the F5 accelerating, even in the, into the 220s, the faster it goes, the faster it wants to go. It's very surreal. Wow. And, you know, you're not just feeling the G-force of the speed. It's a complete sensory overload of sound, of vibration. Even sight, even like where you're looking to, you get there quicker than you thought you would. So your whole body has this whole sensory download of every sense that, again, we're talking about EVs, and I can talk about EVs plenty, but you know, I've got a Tesla Plaid. It's currently my daily driver. It gives you all the G's, but that's all you get. You know, it's somewhat antiseptic, as my doctor friend says about electric cars. Hmm. So.
Anyway, why do you drive? Why do you drive it, John? Why do you drive that as a daily driver instead of something that sounds good?
Well, that's a long list. But the reason I have been driving it up till now is I paid $140,000 for it, and I think it's worth $40,000. So, like, I lost my shirt on resale value, so I might as well just wear it out. Also, at the time when I bought that, and I just bought that car because I wanted to experience it, to analyze, like, do we want to get into that market? And our customers and dealers have since told us they don't want EVs. And now, obviously, you're hearing that from a lot of the rest of the market. But I had ordered an Audi RS6 Avant wagon for my daily driver. It came in around the same time. When my wife saw it, she said, is that my new car? So that car's 3 years old and has 7,000 miles on it. So maybe at some point, out of the goodness of her heart, she'll let me drive that. But I think I'm just about done with the Tesla. I have no issues with the Tesla. It's otherwise a very good car. It has horrible resale value, and it destroys rear tires. I go through a pair of rear tires about every 5,000 miles. Wow. But other than that, it's been a good car.
Does this mean that the Project Deep Space is not happening? And this is the six-wheel, $3 million... This design idea that I remember writing about a few years ago.
That's right.
Is that done?
No, it's on hold. So if we go back 3-4 years ago, we felt like, okay, you know, the OEMs and the government's all talking about, oh, we're going to be all electric 2030, 2035. I'm like, I hope that isn't true. Hopefully the market gets to decide. Hopefully the consumer gets to decide. But if by chance the OEMs and the governments do get away with what I hope they won't do, we have to be prepared to pivot. So we thought of, okay, if we're going to get into the EV, we have to do something radically different. And so that's where the six-wheel drive, long wheelbase, big battery, six motors came from. And then we introduced that. We talked to our customers and dealers about it for the, I don't know, 6-9 months afterwards, and everybody gave it a big thumbs down. And I'm like, well, for at least our customers, they still want internal combustion. So we didn't kill, Deep Space is not dead, but it's on pause, and we can always circle back to it when there's interest. But right now we're looking forward to the next car after F5 will be 100% internal combustion, and we'll kind of see what's after that. You know, when we it was a big bet on F5, I literally bet the family fortune, what little we've got, on developing that car. And so basically what I'm saying is, you guys were referring to others that have not made it financially. I can't afford to make a bad bet and bet on a car that doesn't go, that doesn't sell, where the market turns in the wrong direction. So we are always trying to listen to our customers, listen to the market, and hopefully kind of the old Wayne Gretzky saying of, we want to be skating towards where the puck is going, not where it is right now.
To that point, I wanted to ask you about your kids. I mean, you have five kids. You always talk about your family in every interview, you know. So you're obviously focused on them, and are they focused on you? Are they focused on the business? Is this going to be the kind of thing where they either get into it, or do they influence you heavily in terms of what you're doing in the future?
All the above. I mean, we just, we're 3.1 million Instagram followers. That was me yielding to my oldest daughter and listening to my kids 3 or 4 years ago when we had 300,000 Instagram followers. They've grown it, you know, they've grown it 10x since then. And so, yeah, I think the older I get and the better that the overall team that surrounds them. But look, we want our brand to be relevant from ages and demographics from 8 years old to 80 years old. We don't ever want to go the way of, you know, hopefully nobody gets mad at Harley Davidson, but I kind of feel like some Harley Davidson buyers have aged out and now they're getting older.
That's the
point. So
facts.
We want to make sure that we're relevant. So again, I think listening and yielding to our kids that are ranged from age from 23 to 29. And it's very much, we arm wrestle a lot. We argue a little bit about future product, but I generally, again, on future product and kind of certain directions the company go, I'll give them some leeway to try different things. But ultimately, we want to stay very focused, but we also want to be open-minded to certain pivot points of other, you know, we're talking a lot about resto mods. We don't really want to do Porsches. I mean, obviously, there's a number of other companies doing that type of stuff. So what kind of resto mod would we do? We don't really know, but that's an active, almost daily topic of discussion within the
Corvette.
Family, within the company. So possibly, yeah. I mean, look, with muscle cars, I mean, there's a lot of things we can do. I think Broncos, Blazers, there's a lot of demand for those cars that were the cars that were special to us. Again, I'm 61, so the cars I grew up with, they're, you know, those are our customers. They have the money to spend on those type of vehicles kind of going forward. So it's fun having that. It's fun being able to experience the business with our family.
What do your kids think about electric cars, especially electric hypercars? I mean, is there an argument that there's a younger generation that's a lot more open to an electric hypercar than the older people?
So I've got son-in-law drives a Model 3 to work just because he can just wear it out back and forth. But he also owns a C7 Corvette for a track car. He's got a 1,500 horsepower super sitting in his garage. He's probably a little bit like me that the EV kind of becomes the appliance that gets us kind of where we want to go. But we don't want to rock chip and wear out our special cars, right? Mm-hmm. The rest of the kids are all driving internal combustion. So again, there's pros and cons to that program. But to your question on, you know, look, you've got Pininfarina, you've got Remots with these 2,000 horsepower hypercars. I think the Pininfarina is better looking than the Remots, but technologically, they're both, I'm sure, amazing cars and ridiculous fast. But most of our F5 customers don't want them. I've got one customer that just bought a Pininfarina, but they don't have the emotion, and they know that. So again, it fits a certain part of the niche, part of the market. That's not where we're going to be going. If other people want to get into the, you know, it seems like there's always some EV hypercar that kind of pops up out of the woodwork and makes a big splash, and then you don't hear. At least Geneva Motor Show, there'd be some Chinese company with some new.
Sure.
You know, 1,000 horsepower shoebox, it would show up, and then next year at Geneva, you didn't see them anymore. We don't want to be those guys. We want to be, again, we want to make relevant, smart decisions on future product. And I think so much of that is driven, it's a combination of what I like, what our family likes, but really it's all about what our customers and dealers want. It's about what the public wants.
I just want to talk a little bit about the cars that you like and what where your taste is now versus where it was. I think of you as synonymous with muscle cars. But, you know, you started out with the Mitsubishi and you did a lot of JDM cars. And I know that you also were into like the Super B rally cars. So what do you like right now? Like if you could put together a garage of like two or three cars, what would you pick for that garage?
So like right now, I really want a Venom GT in the stable. We built about a dozen of those. There's a client I might take one on trade. I might build my own. Venom GT, 1,200 horsepower, 1,200 kilos, very lightweight. I definitely want to repo my wife's Audi RS6 Avant at some point. That will be my daily at some point. We might end up with his and hers. We'll see. Gosh, what would be the third one? So the car that my wife and kids gave me for my 60th birthday a year and a half ago, 1969 Olds 442 convertible, which is very similar to the very first car that I bought. So if I had to have three cars right now and plus an F5, so that'd be four cars. So those would be my four cars, you know.
That's a good list. Did you come from a car family, John, growing up?
My dad was definitely a car guy. I was always into cars and always had something new. And so I think I inherited the car bug from my dad, definitely. Okay. But he was the only one in the family. My grandfather was into planes and he was a pilot during World War I. So I guess there's that side of the business. But yeah, my dad.
You know, I wanted to ask, you brought up the Olds and I've seen it on YouTube. And as far as I understand, it's not like a resto mod. It's still original, right? So
it is original.
Which is interesting because you're a guy who mods everything. That's your business. So I wonder, aside from the Olds, because you have that and I know how it's meaningful to you, are there cars that you would like to have that you wouldn't modify?
That's a great question. I mean, in the case of my 442, it seemed like it was fast back when I had mine in the 70s, but it doesn't feel very fast now. So I've been thinking about putting an LT4 in it and tune that up to, 800 horsepower, 850 horsepower. Yeah, no, look, there are other cars. I can tell you a great car. Lexus was very kind about 10 years ago, let me drive an LFA for 2 weeks.
Okay.
That's a car if I own. And LFA would be on my extended list of like vehicles I'd love to own. I don't think I would touch a thing about the LFA, you know?
Wow.
I really wouldn't. Every car is different. I'm trying to think other cars that I really wouldn't want to touch. Nothing really comes to mind. I mean, again, the cars that we want to modify for our clients, we have to have some upside where we can make them more fun, more unique, but they also have to be reliable. They have to pass smog. We offer a warranty. So we have to check all those boxes. But again, for what I would want to do for myself, I love old muscle cars, but look, the carburetor having to pull off the air box and pour some fuel in the batteries go dead. So again, if at some point we pivot towards resto mods, I would want to make it to where like it could sit in your garage for 6 months and you can just go out and just hit the key and it starts the first time. That I think would be a nice thing to have.
Would
sure.
you pivot towards resto mods? Because it seems like a market that isn't going away.
Absolutely. Again, we will likely do it at some point. I just don't know what vehicle it is. I mean, right now we, from design engineering standpoint, I probably have the bandwidth to develop one or two resto mods in the next year or two. But again, I really don't want to do what's already been done unless I feel like I can differentiate our product and our brand in a significant way. So, I'm not going to throw out any names of vehicles, but anybody listen to the podcast, if you want to comment or email us on what kind of a resto mod you would like to see come from Hennessy. But I think it leans towards American muscle, whether it's a muscle car, a sports car or a trucker SUV, I don't know, but, I just generally don't like doing products where it's kind of already been done. Like, again, I love 911s and I there's a particular genre of 911 that's not been done before that I'd love to do, but I feel like Singer and others do such a nice job of it. I don't know if I want to jump into that sandbox necessarily.
Well, if anyone listening has a recommendation for John, the email is hotpursuit@bloomberg.net. Email us with your recommendations and we'll get them to John. And sounds like there's room for some Porsche activity, maybe.
Or not, right?
I know Porsche. You said Singer does it great, but didn't you just say there's
Roof
one
does
or
it,
two?
Theon does it.
Yeah, look, I mean, put it this way. There's a certain type of a 911 that I would like to build for myself that does not really exist in the marketplace currently.
Which type is
and
that?
And so... I don't know if I want to give it away.
Good.
If we end up doing that, I like to keep it a surprise.
I take that as a good sign that you're serious about it.
Yeah.
Whatever it is.
Yeah. We talk about it a lot internally, but we'll see.
I want to finally ask you about the powertrains that you love, John, because obviously that's been your focus for so long. And I guess we can leave out the flat sixes. But are there powertrains that you prefer, like big naturally aspirated motors? Do you like superchargers better than turbos, or does it depend completely on the car? Are there some that really stick out for you?
Look, I'm equal opportunity. I love it all. So if it's rowdy and fast and fun, makes the right sounds, makes the car go feel right, I'm a fan. So I love NA. Again, going back to our days with the Viper, we had big bore kits for the Viper. We did a 9-liter package, and we could get 800 horsepower to the Viper normally aspirated. I love that. Again, when it comes to boost, I can make an argument for supercharger or turbo. I love this feeling and the sound of turbos, but in terms of our business, it's hard to scale big, powerful turbo kits. So predominantly of the 600 vehicles that we're building a year, like we have our Venom 775 horsepower F-150 pickup truck. It's supercharged because we can scale that, and it's got great reliability to it. Obviously, the F5 is twin turbo, but again, we're only doing 11 of those a year typically. So I love them all. Again, I think that, you know, if there's one common denominator, it's kind of American muscle. It's V8 in the case of the Viper, obviously V10. But look, I have no issue with, you know, you can get a GTR to make 3000 horsepower out of a V6. So there's no, I'm not in particular, you know, I don't have anything against the inline six, like the 2JZ and the Super. Those are wonderful motors. But again, there, I guess it just kind of comes down to the V8 and the V10 are kind of special to us. And they've been our kind of our specialty going back for almost 33 years. So we'll probably continue to go down that path.
Good. Yeah.
Thanks for taking the time to share all this stuff. We're watching.
Thank you all.
Eagerly. Yeah.
Loving watching your work, and I'll be watching it with even more focus from now on. So thanks so much for joining us. All right. So awesome interview with John Hennessy. Yeah. I loved listening to him. I loved his answers. I've been looking deeper and deeper into his work recently. So very cool that it looks like they're going to attempt a world record.
Yeah, I think it's exciting. And I just love the Texas connection as, you know, he's just a guy down in Texas doing his thing, and he's earned a lot of respect over the years. So I think that's very cool.
Yeah, he just like went racing a few times and was very successful. And
I mean,
then he was like,
so
I'm going to start
casual.
This tuning business.
I know. Yeah. He's so casual about doing these things that are incredibly complicated and difficult. And he's just, you know, very ho-hum about it. It's
yeah,
kind of cool.
Very cool. And he talks about the potential of resto-modding a few cars, which I think is so tantalizing. I wonder what
yes.
they could be.
I think we need our listeners to email us at hotpursuit@bloomberg.net.
Hotpursuit@bloomberg.net.
And we're thinking, you know, a Porsche, a Corvette, a Bronco, maybe something along those lines.
I wonder.
Send us your thoughts.
I wonder if he'll go the 4x4 route. I wonder if that market has come substantially down. Like, I look on Bring a Trailer and the prices seem to have
I do think
crested.
It's peaked a bit. I
yeah.
honestly do think it's peaked.
But I he could do something that we haven't even thought about. So
I know, that'd be cool.
I would love to hear suggestions, and we'll send them along to John Hennessy. Next week, have you got anything special coming up?
You know, Mercedes is finally unveiling their electric G-Wagon. Now, I drove a prototype of this vehicle last year, and now they're, of course, having the official launch. I'll have something to report about that next week.
All right. Well, I am expecting to try out the Lamborghini, the off-road Lamborghini.
The Sturato.
The Sturato.
Cool.
They're supposed to bring it over tomorrow. And a buddy of mine, he sent me a suggestion that I thought was pretty amazing. And I've never even thought about it before. You could even do a story. The Old Albany Post Road.
Never heard of it.
It's about, I don't know, 15 miles north of me. It's not that far away.
Okay.
It is the oldest dirt road in America.
How do you even know that? How would you claim that?
I don't know. The Old Albany Post Road is apparently one of the oldest unpaved roads in America, or
okay.
the oldest. Everywhere I look, it says it's the oldest. It's about 10 kilometers long, 6.6 miles long, and I'm going to take this, because they told me not to take it off-road, right? The off-road Lamborghini. In the press release, in the loan agreement, it says.
That's not fair.
It says, by the way, don't take it off-road. So I wanted to find a road that wasn't paved.
Yes, that's fine.
Yeah.
Fair game.
It's still a road.
Tally-ho and carry on.
Well, that does it for this week. That's all we got time for. I'll see you here, same time, same place next
week. Same time, same place. Email us, hotpursuit@bloomberg.net.
I'm Matt Miller.
And I'm Hannah Elliott. And this is Bloomberg.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox president Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.